Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Finding the right foundation is harder than ever. Il Maquillage makes it easy to find your perfect match online. No store required. With 50 shades of flawless coverage and over 60,000 five-star reviews, the hype is real. Their online quiz uses AI to find your ideal shade in seconds. And with Try Before You Buy, you can try your full-size shade at home free for 14 days. Take the quiz at ilmaquillage.com/quiz. ilmaquillage.com/quiz.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and at 13 hours GMT on Tuesday the 23rd of June, these are our main stories. The British Prime Minister announces a significant easing of lockdown measures in England. Pubs, restaurants and cinemas will open. Italian police carry out a large operation in Sicily against one of the most violent clans in the Mafia. Scientists are studying the movement of wildlife before, during and after lockdown to find out what impact humans have had on nature. Also in this podcast, a snub to the Black Lives Matter movement here in the UK.
We, as a group of players, condemn it. We're ashamed, we're embarrassed. Completely misses the point of what we're trying to achieve as a football community.
And we hear from Germany about the track and trace app 10 million people have signed up to, despite privacy concerns. But not everyone is happy.
I definitely won't use it. My phone is too old anyway. I don't need this. I don't want this.
The British Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, has announced a significant further easing of the coronavirus restrictions that have been in place since the end of March.
Today, we can say that our long national hibernation is beginning to come to an end and life is returning to our streets and to our shops. The bustle is starting to come back and a new but cautious optimism is palpable. But I must say to the House, it would be all too easy for that frost to return. And that is why we will continue to trust in the common sense and the community spirit of the British people.
Mr. Johnson told Parliament that pubs, restaurants, cinemas and museums would be allowed to reopen from July the 4th, and he said the 2 metre social distancing rule would be reduced to 1 metre where necessary. Our correspondent Rob Watson was listening to the Prime Minister's statement.
That pretty much sees the end of the UK's lockdown on July the 4th. But I guess the main measure is to say that social distancing is going to go from 2 metres to 1 metre. Why does that matter? Because the government had long planned to have what might be called the sort of service sector of the UK economy, incredibly important, seeing as Brits love to eat, drink and go out shopping. So pubs, restaurants, hotels, all of that stuff can reopen on July 4th. And it's thought that it makes that far more economically viable, that customers, staff only need to be a metre apart.
But I suppose not everybody is particularly happy about this. There are a lot of people who are quite nervous and not very enthusiastic about things opening up again. Here is Emily. She's a mother of two and she's very wary.
My whole issue with it is that I don't trust other people. I've seen the way people have behaved before lockdown measures have been eased. There's scant regard for the rules then, and that's including some of the people in power. And I'm not going to go into a restaurant. I'm not going to put myself or my family into any situation where not only could we be put at risk, but we could contract something and then pass it on to somebody more vulnerable in society, because we could be carriers. It's not just about us.
Yeah, Rob, I suppose a lot of these changes really do depend on people reacting responsibly, don't they?
They do indeed, because the government itself says what it's relying on is not so much legislation but guidelines, and as Mr. Johnson repeatedly said, the common sense of the British people. I mean, it seems to me that the government is, of course, taking a risk in the following sense, that whatever way you slice this however much you say we've had scientific advice on this, we're taking all the precautions. I mean, of course, if the infection rate were to go up again in the UK, that is going to be a massive problem for the government. Of course, what Mr Johnson and his ministers have been weighing that against is what looks like increasing signs of a hammer blow, an economic hammer blow from the shutdown that's happened so far. So, of course, on the one hand, Mr Johnson will be very, very worried about infection rates going up. And indeed, he warned, he said, look, if they do, we won't hesitate to reintroduce restrictions. But he's sort of balancing that against concern about the economy.
To Germany now, where there's a reminder that an ease in lockdown is a two-way street, because restrictions are being reintroduced in a district of the German state of North Rhine-Westphalia because of a coronavirus outbreak linked to a meat processing plant. It's the first return of containment measures since Germany began lifting its lockdown in May, and a reminder of the importance of a new corona track and tracing app, which was launched last week. Our Berlin correspondent Jenny Hill has been trying it out.
Well, I've downloaded the app. Every time I, or rather my phone, is in close proximity to another user and their phone for a significant amount of time, it makes a record. It doesn't tell me who they are or where we were, but if within 14 days that person tests positive and tells the app, I'll get a warning and a free test.
Can it replace human track and tracing?
That's a big question. If this app system is better than the analog system.
Markus Beckerdahl is an IT expert and blogger.
The analog system seems to work not very well. You get tested, you have to call to the local bureaucracy, and most of the people don't really remember who they met last week. It might work for 5 people, but not for 500 people.
Corona zu bekämpfen ist ein Gemeinschaftsprojekt. Auch Sie können einen Beitrag.
The app was developed by German companies and government health advisors, but they had to get Google and Apple on board so it could run on their systems. There was furious opposition here to a plan to store the data on a central database where scientists could access it. So the government's gone with a decentralized system. The data is stored on the individual phone. In the centre of Berlin, it's as if the pandemic never happened, even though localised outbreaks are making headlines. People cluster on the grass by the church, others crowd the pavement cafes. The app, for now, can tell with 80% accuracy whether users are within 2 metres of one another. It's reckoned 10 million people have downloaded it so far, but it's not convinced everyone.
I definitely won't use it. My phone is too old anyway. I don't need this. I don't want this. I don't trust technology. I'm analog.
Ich bin analog.
So you have downloaded it?
Yeah.
Why did you think it was important to do so?
It can protect us.
3 days in, I'm opening up the app and it says, nope, I've not been exposed. No one pretends this app is a silver bullet. You need other measures still, like social distancing. Could it be exported? In theory, yes. But if I test positive now, I can't just tell the app. I'd need to enter a verification code, which I get from the health authorities when I'm tested. Without that underlying infrastructure, the app, of which the German government is so proud, simply wouldn't work.
Jenny Hill. Dozens of people have been arrested in anti-mafia raids across Sicily. The two operations, one in Catania and one in Palermo, targeted known mafia clans. Our Italy correspondent Mark Lowen has more.
The largest of the two raids began at dawn. Operation Chameleon, involving hundreds of police officers, led to 50 arrests near the city of Catania. It targeted members and families of an infamous mafia clan whose boss is already serving a life sentence. They're accused of murders, robberies, extortion, and controlling the import and sale of drugs. Meanwhile, in the Sicilian capital, Palermo, 10 arrests were made, including of a mafia boss who has already been in prison, accused of extortion and theft. The president of the Parliamentary Anti-Mafia Commission called it a beautiful day. Police are continuing to search properties linked to those arrested. The Catania raid is connected to an investigation that started more than 3 years ago. The one in Palermo comes after public denunciations. Bit by bit, mafia control in Sicily is being chipped away, but it is still far from being dismantled.
Throughout the coronavirus pandemic, we've concentrated on the effect of the virus on humans. But what about the impact on animals? For many species, COVID-19 has had positive consequences. With fewer cars on the road, they've been able to move around more freely. Scientists across the world are trying to learn lessons from what's happened, as I've been hearing from our science correspondent, Victoria Gill.
We've essentially put the pause button on human activity for the first time. So what these wildlife scientists are saying is that we've got the chance that we've never had before, we may never have again, to study the impact of our own absence on all the other species that we share the planet with. And the way to do that, we've seen lots of things on social media where people are sharing footage of strange wildlife encounters in surprisingly urban settings during lockdown. But the way to measure what impact that's having on particular species in important habitats is really to track the movements of those animals. So this is a group of scientists based all over the world that do that, that put biologgers or little tracking devices on all kinds of different species. And there are dozens of different studies all over the world going on right now. The idea is that we can bring all of that together and we can study the impact of human absence, or the anthropause, as they're calling it, on species all over the world.
So there's an awful lot of information that's already been gathered.
Yeah, the researchers that are coordinating this are really just making it an official and global effort. I've spoken to scientists who have had trackers on whales that looking at the marine environment and the quietening down in shipping activity, because it's not just an impact on our land, it's also on our oceans. You know, there's just been this huge slowdown in human activity. So the effort now is basically to bring all of that together and gather as much information from it as possible, because the key thing is that once we're out of lockdown, this activity will pick up again. So the idea from these wildlife scientists is that we need to understand the impact that it had in case there are lessons that we can learn. Say, for example, you see a real benefit for an endangered species, particular parts of the transport network where it's got a lot quieter and therefore those animals are using those particular areas of road network to move around and migrate. Maybe you could think about those would be places to put wildlife crossings or wildlife corridors, or maybe we could just do tweaks to our transport network that could actually have major impacts. So lessons from lockdown that could have a benefit for nature and for humans as well.
Victoria Gill. Meanwhile, in South Africa and Brazil, human trials for a COVID-19 vaccine developed by Oxford University are getting underway. 2,000 people in South Africa will be involved in what is widely considered to be one of the earliest and most advanced trials for a vaccine to tackle the pandemic. Our Africa correspondent Andrew Harding reports from Johannesburg.
The first doses of the vaccine are being administered here in Johannesburg this week. South Africa has been chosen not just for its expertise in this field, but because COVID-19 is now spreading fast here. That makes it far easier for scientists to find a community at immediate risk of infection and then to tell whether this British vaccine is effective. Similar tests are already underway in the UK, but the infection rate there is slowing, hence the move not just to South Africa, but to Brazil too, where 5,000 people will be involved in the same vaccine trial.
Newborn triplets in Mexico have tested positive for coronavirus, despite having no contact with anyone known to be infected. Scientists say the case may shed light on whether the virus can be passed via a placenta during pregnancy, as is the case for many other viruses. Here's our Mexico correspondent, Will Grant.
It is unprecedented from a scientific point of view, was the conclusion of Miguel Ángel Lutz Steiner, the head of the public health agency in San Luis Potosí. It certainly appears to be. The triplets, two boys and a girl born prematurely on the 17th of June, have all tested positive for COVID-19. Two of the babies are in a stable condition. The other, one of the boys, is receiving treatment for respiratory illness. The babies were tested for coronavirus on the day they were born. The state health authorities believe the parents may have been asymptomatic. They have now been isolated while they await the results of their own coronavirus tests.
Will Grant. The pandemic brought filming around the world to a halt, but has it unlocked another Hollywood opportunity?
I think it's a total game changer what's happening in the world at the moment. It's going to give us more agility and the ability to work with the incredible talent pool that's spread right around the whole world.
We'll hear more about how animation is booming. The skies across the Caribbean should be a bright blue at the moment, but they're looking decidedly murky. It's caused by what many are calling Godzilla dust storm. So what's causing it and where's it going? BBC Weather's Chris Fawkes told us more. we look at the area of dust, we can look at satellite pictures that are tuned just to picking up the dust. And we can see it's extensive right across from the Leeward and Windward Islands in the Caribbean, right the way across Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, Haiti, and into eastern parts of Cuba. So there aren't many places that aren't affected by this very, very large cloud of dust that's come all the way from West Africa.
And is it equally dense everywhere? What are the conditions like for people? Is it going to be dangerous for people in terms of breathing?
It varies a bit from place to place. The worst visibility I've seen earlier this morning was actually in the Dominican Republic, where visibility has dropped to 4,000 metres. And, you know, here in the UK or around the world, you might imagine that to be quite misty conditions that you have during the early morning. So the skies would look probably quite grey, quite hazy, even could have like a brownish tinge to them. But you probably get some very spectacular sunrises and sunsets due to this area of dust. But it'll also have some different effects. It will suppress convection, which means you probably aren't going to get any showers at all due to this dust going through. Could have some bigger effects as well. Now, over the next few months, of course, we're in hurricane season. Now, the hurricane forecast has already been issued. What we see sometimes is when we have repeated episodes of Sahara dust coming over the Atlantic, it suppresses those showers, and those showers are what sometimes go on to form hurricanes. So you can sometimes see the hurricane forecast going horribly wrong with far fewer hurricanes as a result of these episodes of Sahara dust. But that's something we'll just be monitoring over the next weeks and months.
And you say it comes from the Sahara relatively frequently, but this is particularly big, isn't it?
Yeah, some people have suggested this could be the worst dust storm that's come over for 50 or 60 years. I don't really have any evidence just to back that up. Of course, satellites have changed all the way through that period as well. What I do know is this dust storm originated in South Algeria, into parts of Mali, Burkina Faso and Mauritania. So that part of West Africa. And we were talking about visibility really quite poor there, about 1,000 to 1,500 metres visibility as this dust storm went through Thursday and Friday last week. And then it's taken all that time to waft its way across the Atlantic, in the Caribbean at the moment, as we've discussed. Now, the visibility will slowly improve day by day, but it'll probably recirculate actually through the Gulf of Mexico and could affect southeastern parts of the United States, again, with some vivid sunrises and sunsets due to the dust in the sky.
Chris Fawkes, in the US city of Seattle, questions are being asked about the future of a so-called autonomous protest zone, set up in response to last month's killing of George Floyd, the unarmed black man who died in police custody. The Capitol Hill neighbourhood became a police-free zone after city officials made the unusual decision to abandon a police station there following clashes with protesters. And depending on who you listen to, the zone has been held as a utopian space for protesters to gather and make speeches, a festival atmosphere at least by day, but with a darker side at night. Now people have died. The BBC's Lawrence Pollard heard more from Carlen Dalmida, a journalist for Scribbler News, who's reported inside the autonomous zone.
I'm not exactly sure where or when or who decided or who's going to be in charge of this autonomous zone that they're calling it. But it did, in fact, happen to rise up sort of after George Floyd was murdered by law enforcement. So it is a response to that.
And I guess we've seen similar things with Occupy, if you cast your mind back to the various Occupy movements and so on. Is that how we should think of it? At least, let's say, before we talk about the dark side, daytime. Is there a festival feel? What's it like walking around?
During the day, there is sort of a festival feel for sure. People seem to be very carefree. There are marches that are organized by community leaders, where they shout their chants and march around the streets. There are speakers in the park, Cal Anderson Park, and generally during the day, it's very peaceful. There's a lot of people who are passing through just to sort of see what's going on and check it out. But yes, at night, there is an incredibly different atmosphere, and we can talk about that.
Why is that then? Tell us what it's like at night. So festival at day and by night? How would you describe it?
By nighttime, all of the people who are there during the day obviously have left. And the only people who are left seem to be the people who are running the so-called security. That would be the John Brown Gun Club, sort of the armed militant arm of Antifa in that area. And one named Roz Simone, who is sort of been called a warlord of sorts.
Right. That all sounds quite militaristic. I mean, is that the impression that you get? If there's only those people there, what's it like as a reporter going there? Because your stuff, you talk to people, people happily sort of during the day exchange back and forth. They talk about their hopes and their fears and that kind of stuff. At night, what's it been like for you?
Well, I go there undercover, obviously. I've got a hat and a bandana and a jacket, dark colored. I was there really just to record and see if I could catch anything of interest on camera. And so, you know, they recognized that I was filming them as they were sort of huddled together in the middle of an intersection. Essentially, two gentlemen came up to me and started to interrogate me about what I was doing on my phone. They said, if you don't give me your phone, we're going to knock you out and take your phone.
What are the police, the authorities doing now? Any plans to return? Because I understand there's been a couple of shootings in the area as well.
Yes, as of last night, I believe there is at least two confirmed shootings and maybe one or two deaths. But as of Monday, the mayor, Jenny Birkin, I believe her name is, has basically said that the police will be coming back into Capitol Hill to reclaim the East Precinct there. And there is talk of negotiations with community leaders in that autonomous zone to sort of control the hours at which people are allowed to be there doing things.
That was Carlin de Almeida from Seattle's Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone. And now there's also a so-called Black House Autonomous Zone in Washington, D.C., just a few miles from the White House. Sports stars across the world have been showing their support for the Black Lives Matter movement. In Germany, Bundesliga players have been taking the knee before games, and Britain's Premier League stars have been doing the same. But a match in the UK has been overshadowed after a banner with a message "White Lives Matter" was flown over the stadium. Charlotte Gallagher has more.
This was while the players were taking a knee on the field, but Burnley apologised for that action and say that they will be doing their utmost to try and identify whoever was responsible for that.
That's the BBC commentator John Murray. He was one of those who saw the message reading "White Lives Matter Burnley" being trailed behind a small plane. Players were seen shaking their heads in disgust. The condemnation was swift. The club said those responsible were no longer welcome at games and called the banner offensive. It's likely the person behind the stunt will be banned, as the club will want to send out a strong message. The Burnley captain, Ben Mee, said the players were united in their reaction.
We, as a group of players, condemn it. We're ashamed. We're embarrassed. Completely misses the point of what we're trying to achieve as a football community, as a group of players. It's a minority of our supporters.
The banner has had more headlines than the game, which ended 5-0 to Manchester City. And because of the popularity and power of the English Premier League, it's being talked about across the world, not the news coverage the clubs and players want. English football's anti-racism charity Kick It Out said the point of Black Lives Matter is not to diminish the importance of other people's lives. It's about equality. One former player, Ifeanyi Onora, said he hoped the banner would be a catalyst and lead to more conversations about racism.
Charlotte Gallagher, we heard earlier about plans to reopen businesses as lockdown restrictions are eased. Well, some creative industries are dependent on human contact, and they've been particularly badly hit by the pandemic. But one is not just surviving, it's thriving. The animated film business has been actively recruiting throughout lockdown, as our Los Angeles correspondent Sophie Long found out.
The global pandemic may have brought drama and live action to a halt.
That's all, folks.
But the animation business is booming as restrictions push production houses to prove they can work in a truly virtual way. Head of studio at anime brand Crunchyroll and president of Women in Animation, Marge Dean, says timing in terms of technology has been key.
What the pandemic has done is it just accelerated the transformation into being able to really have a virtual network. I mean, people were talking about virtual pipelines, I think, like in the 2000s, but it was never feasible because we didn't have the software that we have today.
Moving to a virtual pipeline may have been pretty seamless, but there are other challenges, like launching a film when cinema doors remain shut.
Jungle Beat the movie.
Why were you crying?
Is it because you're really super freaky?
Rita Mbanga is from Sandcastle Studios, which made Jungle Beat. It's the story of a young alien that comes to conquer planet Earth, but ends up learning about the power of a hug.
So we kind of panicked a bit when we realized the message of our film was, you know, loving and hugging, and we were like, oh my goodness, in a time when the world has been told to stay away from each other, you know, stay home and don't go near anybody else. And so we just thought, let's just spin it and, you know, promote hope and like, we will hug again, you know. And we have a wonderful song, which an amazing writer called Jonas Myron wrote for us and Natasha Benningfield sings on, and it's called Together in This.
Walking through the shadows, out here in the night. Just need some hope for tomorrow. We will be fine.
Natasha and Jonas tell me how you make music at speed during a pandemic. It does help if you're old friends quarantining together.
It's not normal, the speed with which how we got this song together in such a short space of time. Basically, it was like, here's the song, we're going to record it tomorrow. It was a bit daunting, actually.
We did vocals. Yeah. Natasha did the final vocals the night before mix.
Until 4 a.m.
It's unheard of.
We were singing, like, like, you know, because it's lots of harmonies and stuff.
So we were the choir ourselves, because we would have, at the last chorus, you'll hear that's a bit of a choir thing happening. And it's actually us doing the whole choir.
So while the creators of Jungle Beat tap into the hope that planet Earth will hug again so their film won't land on streaming platforms unnoticed, other animators are hoping they'll be able to move back from a virtual writer's room to a real one sometime soon. Nick Kroll, co-creator of Netflix animated sitcom Big Mouth, tells me the virtual world does have limitations, especially when creating comedy.
When you're in a room with a group of people, you can tell a joke and hear laughter and continue to talk through that laughter, and there's not a delay or not a levels issue. Zoom and other similar platforms are great. You can have this very intimate conversation, but as soon as you're trying to hear laughter, it can be hard to hear the laughter and talk over it, which you would normally be doing in a table read or a stand-up environment.
Even if they're finding it tricky, until writers can laugh together in a real room again, the advances made in the animation industry have at least given people something to smile about.
I feel unhappy. I feel so sad.
That report by Sophie Long. Well, the pandemic has forced change on all our lives. For some, temporarily. For others, things will never be the same again. But could it be a turning point, not just for individuals, but for societies? This week, in a series called Rethink, the World Service is exploring how things could change after the pandemic, in our own lives and collectively, and whether that change could be for the better. Today, Tara Westover, the author of Educated, on the lessons she's learned from lockdown. Tara's book, Educated, has sold 4 million copies, with more than 2 years at the top, more or less, of the New York Times bestseller list. And she gives us her perspective.
In the early days of the pandemic, we were told that COVID-19 would be the great equalizer, that it would bring us together, because it would affect everyone alike, rich and poor, urban and rural, members of every racial group, those with advanced degrees, and those who never finished primary school. The idea was that a germ is not subject to those prejudices to which human beings so often are. It's not impressed by money or dazzled by prestige. It doesn't see skin color or subscribe to stereotypes of gender. A germ is blind biology. Its one virtue was its supposed lack of prejudice. Of course, none of that turned out to be true. The virus was not blind. It devastated men more than women, the old more than the young. And in America, where I live, and in many other places, racial minorities suffered disproportionately. So did the poor. So did the less educated. The virus, it turned out, was pretty deeply prejudiced. But there was one meaningful way that the virus was a kind of equalizer, and that is that it made us remember the many forgotten people whose hard work makes our lives even possible. I noticed the change about a week into the crisis. A friend of mine ordered online delivery, and he added a 50% tip. Anyone out delivering curry in a pandemic, he said, has earned every penny. A week later, a pipe burst in the house I was staying in. I was suddenly without running water. But the next morning, a man came wearing a fabric mask. He replaced the pipe, and I had water. He didn't have the luxury of sitting at home in a quarantine. He had chosen to risk it, to help me, to protect his livelihood, and the same choice is made every day by nurses and cooks and cashiers and truckers and factory workers. For all the difficult stories that have come out of this, perhaps the most moving is that nightly racket made on the streets of New York and other cities, as people holler and whistle and bang pans to thank frontline workers. Doctors and nurses, yes, but also caretakers and delivery people, grocers and electricians. A whole army of people who leave their homes every day to keep the rest of us safe and well. These are not the rich and illustrious. They are not the so-called elite. They are often not paid very well for what they do. Many of them did not go to college, and for that reason they're sometimes looked down on by those who did have that privilege. I've been thinking lately that education has become the new social divider, perhaps even more than wealth. We forget that in many cases wealth and education go together, that education has, to a large and tragic degree, become a privilege reserved for those who can pay for it. Our modern economy has a great hunger for college-educated workers, and the result was, before coronavirus, that many workers all over the world felt dismissed and left behind. They felt that there was no place for them in the world we were making. We did, I think, become a little prejudiced against work. We began to believe that if someone is not credentialed, they must not be industrious. We tacitly accepted the idea that the professional classes are somehow harder working or more deserving of respect than people who work with their hands. But everyone deserves respect. And more than respect, they deserve to be paid. They deserve the kind of pay that will allow them to live a dignified life. My friend Gia Tolentino recently observed in The New Yorker that there's something corrupt about a society in which essential workers are paid so little that they cannot survive the emergencies through which they must sustain the rest of us. So here's what I hope we remember as we set about to rebuild our post-coronavirus world. I hope we remember the people who keep the lights on and the factories open, the farms stocked and the pipes clear, who cook and farm and drive and caretake and plumb and wire and wash and build. I hope we remember that we are not two peoples, not the elite and the non-elite, the college-educated and the not, the urban and rural, the white-collar and the blue. We are one people.
And we want to know what kind of change you want to see too. Email us at globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. And that's almost all from us for now, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. Just one more thing from Charlotte Gallagher.
You might have heard the expression, it's not the winning, but the taking part that counts. Well, not in this case. We at the Global News podcast are nothing without you. And so we're asking for your help to try to bag the Listener's Choice Award at the British Podcast Awards. If you think we deserve a pat on the back, then please nip across to britishpodcastawards.com/vote to lend us your support. Taking part is great, but winning is even better.
I'm Nick Miles, and until next time, goodbye.
At William & Mary, we believe today's business education needs to be more than just innovative. It requires a legacy of success, a focus on teaching, an emphasis on technology, and a practical hands-on approach. At William & Mary's Raymond A. Mason School of Business, our online, part-time, and traditional full-time graduate programs apply these strengths to provide the experience necessary to help you succeed. Visit us at chatadmissions.com to learn more.